All right, I'm gonna go ahead and start the meeting. The time is 8:33. It's January 20th, 2021. And I call the meeting of the Complaint Screening Committee of the Arizona Board of Psychologists Examiners to order. Can we please have the roll call, Ms. Michelson?
Yes, Madam Chair. Dr. Gill?
Here.
Dr. Meyer?
Here.
Ms. Shreve?
Here.
We have quorum.
Great, thank you. The Complaint Screening Committee, pursuant to ARS Statute 32-2081H, may dismiss the complaints appearing on this agenda or refer them to the full board for consideration and action. Complaints dismissed by the committee shall not be disclosed in response to any telephone inquiries or placed on the board's website pursuant to ARS 32-2081H1. Upon vote of the majority of the quorum, the committee may go into executive session on any items on the agenda pursuant to ARS 38431. 0.03A2 to review confidential records, or A3 to receive confidential legal advice from the our board's attorney. For those in attendance, please be aware that the chair reserves a right to change the order of the items on the agenda based upon party presence and request to speak. A person or a representative of a person who has filed or received a complaint and is present at today's meeting may make a brief statement up to 5 minutes to the committee when prompted by the chair. The committee may also ask questions of those that speak. This part is a very important part, not that it all isn't, but just for those, please use only initials when referring to patients or children. So just the initials. We know the name, so using initials. This is a public meeting. Be aware that content of many records involved in these complaints is confidential and the content should not be discussed in a public meeting. Be advised that the committee will go into executive session to discuss any confidential records. The committee will now discuss our first complaint, 2005, for Dr. Marcia Frerich. Dr. Gill, you're the lead. Would you please provide an overview of the complaint?
Yes, the complainant is AT, the mother in this case. The licensee is Dr. Marcia Frerich. I'll first give an overview. Mother and father, who are divorced, have been involved in a contentious custody proceeding since 2016 regarding their son, RT. In 2018, mother was awarded sole decision-making for the son, father's parenting time to be supervised. In April of 2020, father submitted a motion to the court requesting a therapeutic interventionist be appointed to the case as directed by the court. Mother submitted two names and Dr. Frerich was chosen. On 4/29, Dr. Frerich was court appointed officially as the therapeutic interventionist for the purpose of reunification, supervised parenting time, intervention and co-parenting intervention. In 6/20 and 8/20, Dr. Frerich submitted her TI reports to the court. She recommended in part that mother participate in individual counseling to address personal issues and for both parents to undergo a forensic psychological evaluation. Dr. Frerich also recommended family counseling with a licensed professional counselor. Father remained in supervised visitation with Annette Ruskin until the assigned counselor agrees that father can resume unsupervised visitation. July the 1st, 2020, mother submitted a motion to the court requesting that Dr. Frerich be removed from the case, but the motion was dismissed. On September the 21st, Dr. Frerich submitted a request that she be discharged from her role as the TI as mother notified the court that she filed a complaint against her. Also on the same day, board staff received mother's complaint against Dr. Frerich. Mother was notified that the matter would be processed as a claim, a legal claim. Claim was sent to three board members. One of the reviewers recommended opening the claim as a complaint based upon the following violations. Based upon ARS 32-2061, 16, section B, violation number one, trained professional competences. The reviewer suggested that Dr. Ferrick may have released mother's confidential address to father. Subsection O, providing services that are unnecessary or unsafe or otherwise engaging in activities as a psychologist that are unprofessional by current standards of practice. Dr. Ferrick may have ordered mother and father to pay for multiple services, and that that may have drawn adverse inferences from the failure to pay for or obtain those services. Section R, failing to obtain patient informed and written consent for release of personal or confidential information to another party, lest the release is otherwise released by law. It was suggested that Dr. F may have released mother's confidential address to the father. Mother's claim. 1 month after her appointment, Dr. Ferrick requested that the family participate in counseling with a licensed counselor, and that the parents undergo a psychological forensic evaluation with Dr. Weinstock. These services would have cost several thousand dollars per month. Dr. Ferrick was aware that mother was unemployed due to the pandemic and could not afford expensive therapeutic treatment. Dr. Ferrick made premature and unsupported statements in her TI reports that father was capable of having unsupervised parenting time without conducting or having a forensic exam conducted or addressing the reasons for his parenting that was initially restricted and supervised in the first place. Dr. Ferrick failed to obtain investigative information to the case. For example, did not evaluate Department of Children's Services reports, history of domestic violence, previous therapy, and medical records. Dr. Ferrick also failed to explain reasons for the recommendation that father have unsupervised parenting time. The TI reports lack sufficient details or address significant amount of evidence provided by mother to include inappropriate communications between son and father. Dr. Ferrick refused to interview any family members and consider relevant information provided by the mother regarding the son's well-being. Dr. Ferrick authorized father to have visitation with sons outside of the visitation facility despite a court order clearly stating that visits take place at the facility. Dr. Ferrick failed to inform mother regarding conversation Dr. Ferrick had with father and visitation supervisor. On July the 30th of 2020, Dr. Ferrick exchanged private communication with the father and the visitation supervisor, agreeing to have supervised visits at father's home without informing mother. Son told mother about this. Dr. Ferrick did not provide mother with fee agreement with a fee agreement prior to commencing treatment, yet send emails requiring payment for TI services. No billing statement was sent. Dr. Ferrick recommended in the TI report the parenting time be changed. Mother's inability to pay for services was, quote, used against her. Dr. Ferrick sent a threatening email with respect to charging the possibility of contempt of court on the part of the mother if she did not participate and pay for services. Dr. Ferrick also improperly questioned mother's arrangement to pay for her attorney. Dr. Ferrick provided false information in her TI reports that the mother failed to bring son to the August 10th supervision meeting. The authorized counselor had requested mother to switch sessions to every Monday instead, starting on that same date of August the 10th. Dr. Ferrick accused the mother by email of continuing to hold sons from father, which is untrue. On June the 6th, Dr. Ferrick sent mother an email on behalf of father's brother for signatures needed for refinancing. Mother was concerned about what kind of relationship Dr. Ferrick had with the father. Dr. Ferrick failed to maintain objectivity and protect her son. Dr. Ferrick appeared to give out mother's protected address when filing a police report against the mother for noncompliance. Dr. Ferrick, as part of accusing mother of noncompliance, requested that officers remove the son from the home. Now, the licensee response is as follows. Dr. Ferrick submitted a 27-page response on November the 12th of 2020. Dr. Ferrick case was reported that the case was litigated for the last 4 years. It remains high conflict, and both parents have filed complaints against a number of professionals that have been involved. Judge chose Dr. Ferrick as the TI on 4/29. Mother and father's relationship has been contentious. Son had not seen father on a regular basis despite a clear supervised parenting order. Father resided in California, owned a house in Phoenix, and flew in to see son, willing to make himself available when needed in Phoenix. During the first interview, father was upset, only saw son 5 times in the last 7 months despite a court order for twice a week visits. Father had not seen son since January of 2020. Father cooperative during the TI process. Dr. Ferrick interviewed mother, who refused to provide more than a few details regarding her personal history. She claimed father was abusive to her and her son. Mother and son lived in a woman's house, we'll call her Joyce, in Surprise, Arizona. Dr. Ferrick found son to be articulate, an articulate 7-year-old, easy to engage. Son could not think what mother could do better, but felt that father could not talk about mother or Joyce, the landlady. Dr. Ferrick reviewed court documents, supervised visit notes, psychology notes, documentations and videos sent by mother, interviewing family and friends. Dr. Ferrick made recommendations in the first TI report, which was accepted by the judge in June of 2020. Dr. Ferrick shared information with the licensed professional counselor. Dr. Ferrick didn't speak with family members, but did speak to 4 friends of mother and father who were local. Father was not described as angry or abusive. Dr. Ferrick reported that father's communication was initially aggressive and at times inappropriate, but father was not a physical or sexual abuse danger to the son and was not verbally aggressive towards the son. Dr. Ferrick recommended a family therapist for the parents. Father remained in supervised visitation with Dr. Ruskin, provided a supervision facility appropriate during COVID-19. Dr. Ferrick recommended a forensic evaluation for both parties. Father previously underwent a psychological evaluation that was not forensic. Dr. Ferrick's reports were intended to be brief, consistent with the court order. Judge removed father, paying 100% of costs to a 50-50 split. Mother was then contacted, or was contacted by Dr. Ferrick regarding the changed financial arrangements. Dr. Ferrick told mother that her behaviors regarding noncompliant could lead to a change to a charge of contempt of court, and emphasized that, quote, this is a fact, not a threat. Dr. Ferrick allowed for mother to participate in a payment plan, but there was no response by the mother. Dr. Ferrick reported that mother had a list of criteria for the transport company to meet instead of allowing a family friend to transport son to facility. Dr. Ferrick's email to mother, the mother continued to make it difficult for father to have visits. The court will lose patience and amend parenting time. In response to mother's complaint that supervision would take place at father's home, there was no intent not to involve her. regarding mother's address. Number one, Dr. Farrick emphasized she did not, never had mother's address, but accessed the mother's address through other sources. Father knew that the mother resided with Joyce, the landlady, and speculated that the address could easily be found. Dr. Farrick received was recused, if she recused herself from the case because she felt mother had no intention to move forward in the therapeutic process. That concludes my report for this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Gill. Appreciate that. We're going to now move to is AT here, the complainant? AT, can you hear me?
Hello.
Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for being with us today. I'm going to, if you would, have you just, you can make some opening comments, and then the board members may have some questions for you.
All right. Thank you so much for this opportunity. I heard this brief about the case, and I would like to clarify something, that father was ordered a forensically informed psychological evaluation in 2018. And that's when his parenting time was supervised. And Dr. Farrick's primarily task was to investigate whether he has complied with the court order, because in past 2 years, he wasn't able to prove that he actually done it. And there was no statements by her were made that he complied or not complied. And the court originally ordered him to do the test and then to do the treatment based on this testing for at least 6 months before he can request any unsupervised parenting time. That was done to ensure that the child's well-being was, that the child's safety was preserved, I would say. But I would, but when he gets his unsupervised parenting time, we can ensure that he will not be in the same situation when he was before, when the parenting time was supervised. Then another thing that I would like to clarify, that there wasn't even enough time. There wasn't any testing done. There was she has only conducted a few sessions before she made those recommendations to the court that the father is fine and he can see the child and supervise. And another thing that I think it wasn't really mentioned, that there wasn't, she made a recommendation. She submitted a recommendation to authorize father to supervise parenting time. However, the court hasn't adopted it yet, but she made the dates that were within like few weeks. And she, I received the phone calls from the officers stating that I wasn't complying with the court order. Meanwhile, there wasn't a court order. There was only recommendations. So they filed the police reports on me when the court hasn't even adopted. And in order to make that such a significant change in parenting time from unsupervised for 2 years to, I'm sorry, from supervised parenting time for 2 years and all of a sudden to unsupervised, there has to be a hearing in front of a judge, that there has to be some evidence presented. If it has to be testimony heard, she was expected to be testifying her recommendations at one of the hearings, which she recused right the day or the day before the trial for custody. So there wasn't able, so she made those recommendations that wasn't able to even verify, because there is no information to support them. She just said that she has no support whatsoever documented why she made those decisions. And I submitted a couple of names. There was not that many options in the court's roster. I was actually agreeing with the therapeutic intervention, because I felt like we needed somebody with a psychological background that is able to assist our family, especially with a, such a high conflict case. And again, when Dr. Ferry claims that I am wasn't allowing father to see his son, that was not true. There wasn't anything like that. The father's been filing and filing complaints against me for not providing the supervised vision solely so he can obtain unsupervised vision based on the fact that I don't allow him parenting time. We lived in Surprise. We lived an hour away. There appear, unfortunately, very limited supervision in the area where we reside and requires me, unemployed, to transport him hours away to provide the visitations, but I have not denied the father any parenting time at any time. So this statement that she claims that the father didn't see his son for 5 months, it wasn't anything to do with that me not providing the visitation. That was the father not exercising his parenting time and just filing the false claims against me. So.
We may have some questions for you. Do you have any further, just a few more comments, and then we'll probably have some questions.
Okay. If you have questions, it would be probably easier this way. You read the, I submitted all the proof and all the emails.
Yeah, and for just both parties, we've read it, a lot of information. Thank you. A lot of documents on this. So thank you. Board members, do you have questions? And if you're not speaking, if you could put your phone or your Zoom on mute, we're getting a little bit of feedback and I'm not sure where it's from. Dr. Meyer, Dr. Gill, do you have any questions? All right, I do have a question. Did you receive a payment agreement or any kind of documentation on what the charges were going to be?
I have not received anything.
Have you received any invoices or billings?
I have not. I only received the number in the email saying that I owe her that much.
So no itemized billings or any kind of documentation of what is what you would be paying for?
No.
And when you went into the counseling, what was the agreement on who's going to pay for what?
Originally, the court ordered that we split the TI. I was obviously tried to find the other solutions because I could not afford at that time. I wasn't working. But the court eventually allowed him to pay for most of the stuff and then determined that at the end of the case. So it would be later determined based on the, how after parties been evaluated, but we've never been evaluated.
All right. And the doctor sent you an email on behalf of the father's brother in regards to some kind of refinancing of the home. Was there any reasoning why she was being a go-between between your ex-husband, I guess, brother, and sending you documentations regarding something not related to the case?
I chose her as a neutral party. I had no way of knowing if she had any relationship to the father. And I received prior a few emails from his brother. And again, the place that she's referring to is father owns it. And I used to have, I guess, some of the part in it because I was married to him. So there must be signatures required for me for them to complete certain matters with the bank. And yes, I have no idea why it requested information from me.
All right. And then there was an email where the doctor mentions that you paid your attorney money, but you haven't paid her money. And I think she said you paid your attorney, I think $5,000, if I'm remembering right. How would she know that?
So she would know that from father only because, I retain an attorney, we provided the financial affidavit to the court in which I listed that I already spent $5,000 for the retainer. So she would not have access to financial information. I'm sorry, affidavit, so father probably would get provided that information to her.
All right. And how did you feel when you received an email that basically, and I'm trying to find the email and all these documents, I should have written down the page number, in essence, something to the extent that, you know, you haven't paid, so it would not be looked on highly by the court?
I think it's a little bit confusion. I think maybe you referred to the email where she said that. That's initially, that's within like a few weeks from when she was appointed to the case. She said that that I was there was a risk for me of losing the custody altogether, and that's because she assumed that I would withheld on purpose the child from father. I think you're referring to this one.
Okay.
And yes, that was very scary because I was so excited, and I was sad, but I thought this is going to be a help to our case. And within a few weeks, it was one of the few first communications with her when she pretty much told me that I'm at risk. Well, we're here trying to resolve father's abuse to the child and try to help the father to be a better parent and eventually get them, you know, his parenting back. And here she's threatening me for no reason whatsoever, saying that I'm at risk of losing my custody. And I've been a primarily and sole parent for this child. There's no basis for it. It was very scary for me because her opinion in the courts is very powerful. And I know that judges do not even, sometimes they rely solely on the therapeutic intervention experts in the case to make future decisions. And this is, unfortunately, this is why I haven't been represented for several years, but this was such a intense case there where I needed a legal help because I wasn't sure how I'm going to protect the child from this instant unsupervised parenting time with making sure that father is safe to parent.
All right, thank you. And I'm looking at two different computers, so forgive me if I'm not looking at you, plus my notes that I took when I was reading on the document. So, all right, I don't have any further questions. Board members, do you have any questions just to follow up? All right, hearing none. AT, thank you for being with us. We're now going to move to Dr. Farrick, and she's being represented by Mr. Eves. So if you could introduce yourselves, and then I'm not sure, Mr. Eves, if you have some opening comments, and I'll leave it to you guys to do that.
Thank you, Ms. Shreve. My name is Artie Eve. Thank you for having me this morning. Dr. Farrick is here as well. I'm gonna make some brief comments based on what I've heard here today, and then Dr. Farrick has prepared a brief statement to follow, and then she'll be happy to answer any questions that you have. First of all, I'd like to emphasize that this was not a therapeutic relationship. This was a court-appointed role. In this role, Dr. Farrick was serving and advising the court. She was not providing any therapy to either AT or her ex-husband. In this case, what she did was assess their needs and then make referrals to appropriate providers. There's been a lot made of the fact that the ex-husband, MP, did not attend his assessment. Well, neither did AT. I mean, the problem in this case was that AT would not cooperate or participate in any way with Dr. Weinstock, who was supposed to assess both of them. MP actually did report for his assessment, filled out the paperwork, did everything that was necessary. Dr. Weinstock told him that he would not proceed with the assessments unless he could assess both sides. AP continued by not paying what she was supposed to pay for the services that were ordered by the court. He also continued by doing things like when there were arrangements for MP to come into town to spend time with his son. He flew in from California and showed up just for the purpose of getting his 3 hours of supervised time with the son. AP no-showed, was unreachable, couldn't be called. So there were constantly situations going on like this. And so, you know, it was a difficult high conflict divorce. You know, Dr. Farrick has been handling high conflict divorce and custody situations for years. She's a trusted advisor to the court, and that's what she was doing here. She's never had a complaint, which is surprising. We all know that based on the type of work she's doing. The other thing I would say is that, 5 years ago, this is the type of complaint that would have been subject to absolute immunity. It's not, and I'm not arguing that it should be. The statute has clearly changed, but there was a reason for that immunity. The reason is that because the people who agree to do this type of work, the TIs, often find themselves alienated from one side or the other in terms of the spouses in a custody situation. And prior to that statute becoming moot, essentially, they would have been immune from these complaints. And I think that it was a shame that we lost that immunity, because it's going to discourage people from, like Dr. Farrick, from participating in this much needed role. So this did go through a pre-screening process before it got here. And I believe, as I understand it, the two psychologists who reviewed this case found no problem and no reason to have this reviewed. It was only the layperson on the committee who forwarded this along for review by the complaint screening committee. Certainly there are very capable lay people on this board, and I don't mean to suggest otherwise, but I believe that the psychologist understood the roles here and saw that there was no therapeutic relationship. As to the payment agreement, that was court-ordered payment. This was not the traditional therapeutic relationship. Many of the statutes that apply in situations where there is a therapeutic relationship established do not apply in this case. This is a case where the bills were ordered by the court. And as AT has already told you, the orders were constantly changing. At first it was the husband was gonna pay, I think at first it was 50-50, then the husband's ordered to pay 100%, then back to 50-50. So I can understand why there's some confusion on AT's part about what she might owe, but she never paid a dime, despite court orders that she do so. So anyway, those are the comments that I have, ladies and gentlemen. I'm sorry to take up some of Dr. Farrick's time, but I'll turn it over to Dr. Farrick for her comments now. And then when she concludes, she'll be available for questioning. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Reeves. Dr. Farrick, please, you need to take yourself off mute, which is what we all forget to do.
Exactly.
There you go. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you very much for giving me this opportunity to talk to the board regarding this complaint. Just a short bit of background on me. I'm licensed both here in Arizona and the state of Ohio as well. And since 96, I've been doing forensic work. I originally started down that career path doing death penalty mitigation work in Ohio. And, you know, I've really been blessed. I've been able to work with some very fine psychologists in both the clinical and forensic fields, and have gained a wide breadth and depth of experience, and feel very privileged to have had that opportunity. And that's included working with Dr. Ray Lemberg, who's, I believe, recently retired, and Dr. David Weinstock on cases here in Arizona. And that's been a wonderful opportunity as well. In regards to this case, as I have to say, this was the most difficult TI case that I've ever done. As you've seen, it was a high conflict, highly litigated case with multiple issues running. And I want to just reiterate again, this was a forensic case. This was not a clinical case. That I was chosen by the court, and that I did not have a therapeutic relationship with any of the family members. And of course, as you all know, this serves to avoid a conflict should I be called to testify for the court. I also believe it gives the participants more freedom to be more open and honest with the therapist they are working for, because there's not that direct linkage back to the court. Once I meet typically with the members, and with this family, it was really clear to see we needed to get them to some experts in the field, thus the referrals to Dr. Weinstock, who had the expertise because of the heavy litigation in this. I referred to him because he's both an attorney and psychologist, and felt he would do a good job. And if you saw both of them, they wouldn't have double fees for, you know, family history and background and interviewing the other one. They would get that all done at one time. And I thought he could really see through a lot of what was going on for the family here, and referred to a very experienced family therapist who's worked both here and in California for decades, worked with DCS, worked with family law cases, has a dearth of experience with all types of issues, but is especially good with people with personality disorders. So really felt that this would be a good match with this family.
Dr. Farrick, this is Jean Galvin. If you could refrain from referring to any diagnosis that may be involved.
Sure. There was no diagnosis. I don't diagnose at all, but there was.
There is certainly an implication by your statements. I would ask you to refrain.
Well, I was just stating in terms of her expertise area. Yeah. Thank you. In this particular situation, I just monitor the progress of the case and the participants through the therapist and sometimes the family members. I revise plans as the therapists think things need to shift and change. In this case, one of the participants was working hard to be compliant, at least attempting to be compliant, while the other didn't seem to perceive the benefits of the TI process and the therapeutic process itself, including refusing co-parenting and all the things that were suggested in terms of moving forward. My original hope for the case was to create a child-centered focus for this family. Unfortunately, it became really clear for me that the parents wanted to litigate the case, and therefore I resigned. I was hoping that a different TI would be more effective than I was being with the family, and I really wish the best for this family, and I hope especially for this child, that he could have both parents whom he really loves and he's attached to in his life. He's a precious little boy. Excuse me. As you know, working with these high conflict family cases is very difficult. And it often means at least one parent is very angry with us. And with our recommendations. And I don't think this case in that way is any different than the many of the others that I see. And unfortunately, I'm seeing more and more, and I think many of us are that are TI, seeing more and more alienation via litigation. And I think that you will all be seeing, unfortunately, more of these complaints come down. And I think this will discourage other psychologists, excuse me, from doing this work that's so badly needed for these families. And I really hope that you'll consider that also as you're moving forward with this case. I appreciate your feedback and really open to your thoughts, suggestions, questions. So thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Dr. Gill, Dr. Myers, do you have any questions? Dr. Gill?
Dr. Farrick?
Yes.
I'd like for you to comment on the charge that you violated confidentiality and with respect to the mother's address. There is some confusion here that on some of the documents I saw that the address was protected. But then I also understand that that address may have been made available through other sources, I think, as you put it. Mm-hmm. But I'd like you to explain your response to the charge that you violated confidentiality by sharing this information with third parties. And as a follow-up to that, whether you shared this information with the father.
Sure. I did not share the information with the father. Father had mother's address, But when we did a wellness check on mom when she didn't show, which is standard procedure for my office for all clinical forensic cases, if we cannot get a hold of an individual that's supposed to be somewhere, we just, my staff automatically will do a wellness check. We did not have mother's address on file. My assistant let me know that. She had refused to give us that information. So what I did do was contact one of the other therapists who did have the information. We did do a wellness check. That information was given to the police to do a wellness check on mom. No police report was filed on mom. This was simply to check to make sure mom and child were okay. There was absolutely no intent to hurt mother in any way. We just wanted to make sure she was safe and okay because we weren't getting any response from her. So we were worried.
Dr. Gill, if I may too, I think it's pretty clear from our response that she never provided the address to father. It's a pure supposition on AP's part that that happened. In fact, AP's address is available to any of us right now, her landlady's address. I'm trying not to use the name. We could find that address quite easily with just her name. You can go to the assessor's website and find that address in about 30 seconds. Mm-hmm.
I guess my follow-up question then is, why was that indicated on the court documents as a protected address?
I can tell you that too. I was a former prosecutor and my address was protected because I was under a number of death threats. And so my address could not be given out. At the same time, my address was widely available on various government sites like the one I mentioned. And so it is a shortcoming of our system, but that is one that exists.
Okay, thank you. That's all I have.
Thank you, Dr. Gill. Dr. Myers?
No questions.
No question. I do have a couple just follow-up questions. Sure. And just from a perspective of, could you explain just the mention of why an email from the father's brother was forwarded through you to the mother?
There was an OOP on father. There was no neutral party assigned to.
What is it? Could you explain OOP?
Yeah, order of protection.
Got it.
Had been filed. So father could not directly communicate with mother. So at that point, I was the neutral party in terms of communication. I simply forwarded the information to them. I have no connection to anything or anybody. I was just simply serving as the neutral party for communication between the parents at that point, because one had not been assigned by mother, or she did not, you know, there was nobody to send that information through except me.
All right. And then just also, could you just also discuss the fee agreement and how that works? So if someone is appointed by the court, you're assigned to them, how do they know what this is going to cost? I mean, it obviously, you know, financially it affects the person, right?
Right.
And not
every, right.
It can be expensive. Right. So how does that work? How is the client informed, right, and who do they pay, and do they get invoices? Do they know what they're paying for?
Yeah. I have somebody that manages the billing for me. I don't do that personally. So I'll give you my best understanding of how that gets managed. And this was confusing because there was multiple changes. I think this went back and forth three or four times in the few months I had the case. So it was difficult. Originally, father was the one on that. So he got the original paperwork for all the financial information. He was 100% responsible, and father did end up paying 100% anyways, because he wanted things to continue to move forward. When the court asked that it be split 50-50, mother was sent paperwork. I don't know if she looked at it. She never filled it out. She never returned it. And mother had concerns about paying. We offered a payment plan. We extended several times to assist her in any way we could with that. We knew COVID was going on. We had done that in a few cases where we knew things were difficult for one or both of the parents at that time. We weren't trying to make things hard for mom. We were really trying to work with mom. in terms of getting this moved forward for her. And I don't know if that answers your question, but
All right, thank you. All right, I don't have any further questions. Again, I'd ask my other committee members any further questions. Okay, hearing none. Dr. Farrick, thank you, and Mr. Eaves, thank you. The committee now is going to begin deliberations. Please note deliberations is a time for the committee members to deliberate the case among themselves without interruptions from complainant, licensee, or attorneys representing the licensee. Dr. Gill, you're the lead on the case. Would you like to start with the deliberations?
Well, I, in a careful review of the violations that were stated during the legal claim aspect of this case, two issues come up. One is the informed consent issue. And I think that with respect to the informed consent issue, the TI did not have a therapeutic or clinical relationship, I should say, with the family, and certainly not with AT. So I don't think that there's a violation of informed consent here. I think that the agreement, the court agreement, spelled out the role of Dr. Farrick fairly clearly. It's multiple pages, and I think that that information everyone has access to in terms of understanding her role and how she should conduct himself with the family. So I don't see any violation in terms of informed consent. With respect to the issue of confidentiality, I did ask that question, and I think I gathered some information that led me to believe that there's been no violation of confidentiality here. It appears to me that while this was a protected address on one aspect of, found in the court documents, that in fact this address was made available, and the father knew the landlady's name, and apparently knew the address anyway. So I don't see how there could be an expectation of privacy under those conditions. So I don't see a confidentiality issue either. And so I think I'll stop there. Thank you.
I would agree. I don't see any violations here.
All right. So do I, and I appreciate both your thoughts, and I would agree with that. Do I hear any motions?
I make a motion that we dismiss this case.
Seconded.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any discussion? Hearing none. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, motion carries. I would like to thank both parties for being here today. We do appreciate that and the opportunity to discuss this case with you. All right, we're now going to move to agenda item number 4, which is the adjournment of the meeting. Is there, before I say that, I'd just like to thank the staff. Thank you, staff, for getting us all the information. You guys are the best, truly. And Ms. Galvin, thank you so much. So is there a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Second.
And we had a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
All right. Hearing none, we're good to go. All right. Thank you, everybody. The meeting's adjourned. And